So the web and society are under attack. Rather than being a tool for empowering people, improving lives and protecting democracy, it's evolved into a system for surveillance, control, and coercion. And I believe that we can fix some of these problems with a better foundation. So surveillance, you can get most of the way there with end-to-end encryption. Control tends to come in two kinds. You've got holding your data hostage and holding your identity hostage. You can solve those with host-independent data and user-controlled identity. And then the rest of surveillance, there's a long tail of metadata, including things like the social graph. So these were the design goals we had building the PIGOS protocol. So what it is, it's a global end-to-end encrypted social file system. There's fine-grained access control to individual files or entire directories. Everything's signed and content addressed. You can automatically move hosts and preserve all your links. Everything just works. And there's a sandbox for running applications or websites in a fun way. And of course, user-controlled identity. The model we have is the server is an adversary, a current adversary. So everyone has a home server. And all data is content addressed, all updates are signed, and we layer on top of that end-to-end encryption. So that gives you your location-independent addressing and so your host mobility. As far as the user's data actually goes, they have a tree of key pairs. Each key pair can own any number of other key pairs, and that ownership relationship is proved with a mutual signature, and that comes from a single root key, which is your identity key pair. And if we lay these out, each key pair controls a writing subspace, we call it, or a mutable space. And each of those has a single Merkle tree associated with it. Now, what is the structure of these Merkle trees? It's basically a thing called a champ. So this is a compressed hash array mapped prefix tree. You can think of it as a key value store. It has some nice properties. So it's independent of insertion order, unlike a B tree, and it's balanced. If you've had anything to do with AT Proto, you might have heard of MSTs. MST is the sorted sister data structure of a champ, and it's used in a lot of places in functional languages like Scala for collections and maps. The way we use it, the keys are all 32 random bytes, and the values are cryptree nodes or encrypted metadata, which we'll see more about. Each of those, each cryptree node can link to up to 5 encrypted blocks. Each of those is up to 1 megabyte. So you end up with this kind of granularity for every champ mapping corresponds to up to 5 megabytes of data. And the idea is different mappings in the champ can't be linked by your server or anyone who has access to all the data. So that's how we can hide the file size, at least the sort of the absolute size. And then within a chunk, we also pad to a multiple of 4K to further obscure the file size. In terms of other metadata, whether a particular chunk is a file or a directory, the server can't tell because the format's the same. And things like the obvious things like the files and folder names, all other metadata like MIME types, creation date, the folder topology is not visible, and also the social graph. So who or even how many people have access to a particular file or blob. Which brings us to access control. So to access a particular cryptree node or chunk, you need a capability. So what's a capability? It's pure information. People from Sparty will say you either have it or you don't. That's a good description. It's not identity-based. And because it's pure information, it can work in things like secret links if you want. And you can revoke them by essentially rotating the keys. So in our setup, there are 3 different kinds of capabilities. There's a mirror cap, a read cap, and a write cap. So the mirror capability is just, can I retrieve the ciphertext for this thing at all? And that has four components. The first two are public keys. There's the owner public key and the writer public key. The owner is basically used for routing to your server. And the writer is the thing that controls the writing space that you're actually trying to get the data from. The map key is just a lookup key into the champ. And the BAT, so BAT stands for block access token. It's basically 32 bytes. You can think of it as a bearer token for that particular chunk or block. And so with a mirror cap, you can then ask the server, give me this encrypted cryptkey node, and it'll give it to you if the BAT's right. And then if you have a symmetric read key in addition, then you can decrypt it and you can read it. If you have, in addition to that, a symmetric write key, then you can then modify that file or folder as well. The read keys are controlled with a structure called cryptree. So basically, every file or directory has two symmetric keys associated to it. And if you, with this diagram, the idea is if you have one of these keys, you can follow the links in this picture by decrypting things in the cryptree nodes. So if you have the base key for a directory, then you can decrypt all the capabilities in that directory and see all the children and so on. You might notice these backlinks from the parent keys. That's essentially to give everything a well-defined path. So if I can give you a read cap to a file, and you can, that file still has a well-defined path in the system. The write cryptree is a lot simpler. It's just one symmetric key for everything. And if you have that, then you can decrypt the signing key pair for that appropriate thing and modify some stuff. So we've talked about capabilities for individual chunks, but what about, we said they're different for different chunks. So how do we read the rest of a file, say, if we're trying to watch a movie or something? So the owner and the writer are the same for a given file. And the read key and the write key are also the same. So the things that change are obviously the keys in the champ, the map keys, and the bearer tokens, the BATs. So if you have the capability to the start of a file to get the next one, you just hash the current map key with a thing called the stream secret, that's stored in the encrypted metadata in the first chunk. So you decrypt it, get the stream secret, and then hash it. And the same thing for the BAT. And then you've got the capability to the next chunk. And you can continue going on like that. And so to seek forward, you don't actually have to do any I.O. at all. You just do this hashing locally, get the final capability, and then just ask for the data. So it's O of 1 in I.O. to seek in an arbitrarily large file. So that brings us to the first demo. Let's pray to the demo gods and see if that will work on the internet here. You see that? Yeah. All right, where are we? Over here. So this is just a bunch of videos. So this movie is about 120 megs, not enormous, but it's not tiny either. So you can see it's already buffered quite a lot, but I'll skip ahead of that. There's no sound because my sound's off, but that doesn't matter. And you can see you can seek ahead pretty quickly. You can also seek backwards, and that's relatively fast. If you're wondering how we do that, we don't do anything clever there. We just keep the pointer to the start of the file. So you're always hashing forwards because you can't invert a hash. Cool. Last time I did that demo, it didn't work. So I'm pleased about that. So this gives us a file system. Cool, but that's not a web. A web has websites and web apps, so we need a way to do that. So a way for that is we have a sandbox to run anything, run an application or view a website. And the idea is it's locked down so that it can't communicate to the external world. And so you could then run an app over private data such that it can't steal it or exfiltrate it in any way. And it also can't read anything it's not been granted access to. And it works in existing browsers without any add-ons or extensions. And from the app's perspective, it thinks it's got a simple REST API. It doesn't know anything about encryption or any of that stuff. It thinks it's talking to a server, and that's happening locally with a service worker, which, well, we'll see more in a second. So what is an application? It's just a folder of HTML in Pyrgos. Because it's just a folder, you can use the built-in access control. You could keep it private, or you could share it with friends, or make it public. There are some basic permissions for apps, so you can register for certain MIME types. You can say, I'm an image editor, or I can play music, or whatever. And you can have, there's a permission for persisting data in kind of like an app-specific private folder in your space. So it's basically the same as Android, where apps can store stuff on your phone, except it ends up in Pyrgos. And an app without any permissions is just a private website. This is how it works technically. So you have the outer context on the left, which is Pyrgos.net, or it could be localhost. So this all works on localhost as well. And that's where you log in. That's where your keys are. That's the kind of trusted context. And when you run an app, it loads a random subdomain, whether it's Pyrgos.net or localhost, doesn't matter. And that subdomain, all it does is the server serves up the same code for all subdomains. And that code just immediately loads a little service worker and then tries to load itself in another subdomain, iframe. And that iframe is where the app itself ends up. So all the requests the app makes get intercepted by the service worker. And the service worker translates them to post messages, which are sent back to the outer context, where they can be interpreted and have whatever permissions applied, and then the responses are sent back. And yeah, so it's done with this CSP to lock it down, but also co-op and co-op to try and make sure that it's a different operating system process than the outer Pyrgos context to protect against side channels. So what kind of things can an app do? there's a word processor, spreadsheets, image editors, all kind of obvious things. And we haven't written all these. These are like existing web apps that we've just trivially ported. TiddlyWiki notebooks, Markdown editor, and like you don't have to rely on us to write apps. Anyone can write an app. You can launch an app from a folder. I'll show you that later. You could have a media player. One of the APIs we expose to apps is the ability to send a message to your friends or to particular friends. So using that, you can build stuff like multiplayer games or chat, and you can do things like Doom. So, second demo. All right, so let's see. So I'm just going to show you. So this is a Word doc, a DocX. There you go. So that's this thing at the top is kind of like a trusted, it's a bit like the URL bar. So that's not controlled by the app, but below that, that's the app rendering itself. There's an ebook reader. If you want to do some linear algebra. So there's a block-based note editor or viewer. So this is standard block-based things. You can have inline images or LaTeX or diagrams or stuff. And that was just the viewer for it. If I go edit, then you can see I get these things for adding and editing new things. So, you can give it, when you open an app, you can give it read-only access to stuff. Let's try and change something. I'm halfway through that. And then, seems to work. If we open it again, there we go. All right, so that's saved. There's a PDF viewer, lots of PDFs, probably the most sandbox PDF viewer in the world. Whoops, no, didn't want to go back in there. Some spreadsheets, so this is an Excel spreadsheet. There we go, there's some stuff. What else have we got? So there's a text editor, this is basically Code Mirror. So if you like your text code end-to-end encrypted, there we go. There's a Go file. I can do Markdown as well. So that's the Markdown renderer. Or if you go to Edit, then that's Code Mirror. And so even just raw HTML. So this is just a trivial little website. So you can see here, it just has an image referencing in the same directory. And if I view that, then I get, this is sandboxed off, this little website thing. And yeah, in this case, we do actually show the path up here in the sort of trusted URL bar. And you can have a full-fledged wiki, so it's Markdown, but it can link to sub-documents, inline images. You can link to any file, and so, what's this? This is a note, and it will open that in the appropriate app that you, whatever you have registered. And there's a calendar, basic calendar. The model there is that every event is a standard iCal file in Pyrgos. Each calendar is a folder, so you get the native access control that way. And you can share it with people that way. And one last thing. So there's a search. So this is searching in the file name. So this is just searching metadata, but this is not pre-indexed. This is just doing it live. And you can see it's relatively quick. I can try and do a full text search. So this is searching MySpace at the moment, which is 10 gig, I think. But you can see it's faster. We thought we were going to have to add an index to that, but it's so far been fast enough to not have one. We might still do one day. And yeah, so you can see all the apps I've personally installed in this account here. There's one more. So here are some example apps, the actual source code of the apps. This is Doom. Basically, it just has an assets folder that'll just have an index.html. And there's a manifest. It's just a JSON file. And from that, we can just directly run it this way in the sandbox. And then, yeah, that runs. Not multiplayer yet, unfortunately, not Doom. One day. Awesome. All right, so back to the slides. Rightio. So one thing I haven't talked about yet is the social side of it. So I talked about sharing, but we also have kind of a social media protocol, I guess. It's more of a format. But our belief is that most social media is actually bad for society for two main reasons, because it allows micro-targeted political profiling, which can be used to swing elections and subvert democracy, and because they're designed to be addictive. But if you compare it to something like normal in-person conversations, I think these are good for society. These are how we reach consensus. They're mostly mutually consentful. And so that's how we've tried to model the social media on in-person conversations or meetings. And so it's like everything else in Pigos, it's end-to-end encrypted. A social post is just a file. And you share it, you choose the audience, so you can be your friends or your followers or some subset. And if the original poster wants to allow sort of increasing the audience, then that can be allowed, like resharing. Or you can just restrict the audience to the original audience. But yeah, so without privacy, there can be no democracy. Thank you, everyone. Go try it out, self-host, sign it up, write some apps. Happy to take questions.
All right, we do have a few minutes for questions. We'll go ahead and pass it around.
Really impressive demo. Well, in presentation and everything, one of the things you were very focused on, kind of the and then encrypted file case. If you wanted to do some sort of publish, subscribe, or otherwise message passing system, like what type of mechanism, or is it basically a polling mechanism on the encrypted data?
It's basically polling, yeah. So the way the sharing and the social stuff all works is when you friend someone. Okay, so I haven't really talked to the details of friending. You can send someone an encrypted follow request, and that gives that basically you share with them a capability to a particular file in your space, and that is your broadcast mechanism to that person. So you can just append stuff to that in your space, and then they can come and read it whenever they like, and then follow the caps elsewhere. So yeah, that's basically how it works.
Over here. Hi. Thank you very much for your presentation and for the efforts that you put into something that feels very right. I wanted to ask you, what do you think that the audience here can do for Pigos? Like, what do you think it's necessary next step, especially regarding the targets that you have here? What can we do?
I mean, try it out, use it, give us feedback. We're a non-profit, so if you want to support us, you can donate or get a paid account on our server if you don't want to self-host. All of the above.
Yeah, but also specifically targeting developers, are there works that are left that you think that can be like lifted up? Some.
Targeting developers.
Would it be like, would you recommend like developers to look at like new apps to integrate in your platform?
Oh yeah, like? Yeah. So yeah, we'd love to have more apps. And if you want it to, there's a centralized install thing to make it easier for people to find me. You don't have to do that. But yeah, there's a web. Is it on there? No, it's not. Well, there's a link on pigos.org which goes to book.pigos.org that has. The app API, for developers to figure out what's going on. Most of it's pretty simple though. There isn't an SDK. It's that simple. It's just posting or getting HTTP to a couple of endpoints.
Thank you, Alain. In your opinion, which is the best way a user can manage his private keys, and also how the revocation method works?
What was the second part?
How the revocation of permission works.
Oh, the revocation, yeah. So the private keys, I've got a slide somewhere about login. Let me see. Oh, there we go. Yeah, so basically when you log in, you've got your username and your password, and we put those through with a salt through script. And that gives you two things. You get a login key pair and a symmetric key. The login key pair is then used to auth with the home server. So the home server stores your encrypted identity there. And you can back it up if you want. And that is then decrypted with the symmetric key to get you the three things. So your identity key pair, the social key pair, which is what's used for follow requests, and the capability to your root directory. And in terms of revocation, so It's handled automatically, but if we go back to CryptTree, right, so if someone has access to one of these keys, then you have to rotate the entire subgraph that's reachable from that. So read revocation is not too expensive. Write revocation is a bit more expensive. But yes, it is. If you have a big directory and you're trying to revoke access, that can be expensive. If your threat model doesn't necessarily need like a full key rotation, then there's a sort of an intermediary we have, which is secret links. And you can just basically delete the secret link, and then that link will not resolve anymore, even though the keys underlying are the same. Depends on your threat model, but yeah.
All right, thank you, everyone. Let's go ahead and give them another round of applause. Thank you, E. I appreciate it. We're going to go ahead and start changing over, Jessica.